You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the Democratic State Convention starts this Friday. We'll talk to a political scientist about what we can expect. First, after several previous failed attempts to pass in Congress, the Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act was signed into law by President Trump in March. The bill was introduced by Congressman Jim Costa, a Democrat whose district in California includes one of the largest Hmong communities in the U.S. Here he is in 2015 when he unsuccessfully reintroduced the bill.
This legislation would allow the burial of these Hmong veterans who live here today and their families in national cemeteries, like the San Joaquin Valley National Cemetery in Merced County. This recognition is long overdue. We granted it to Filipino soldiers who fought side by side with American soldiers in World War II. I hope my colleagues will support this legislation to ensure that those Hmong veterans and their families receive the proper recognition by providing them burial rights that they have earned.
Chia Yuyi Vang is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is the director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. Chia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you briefly tell us how Hmong soldiers came to fight alongside American troops in the Vietnam War?
Well, it's a very long story, right? I think we know a lot about what happened during the Vietnam era, and we know that it wasn't, you know, that the name of the Vietnam War has come to be sort of an inaccurate description of what actually happened in that part of the world. So it's a Vietnam War, but I think as I've talked to many people, the people in Asia call it the American War. So in fact, it's, you know, called the Vietnam War, but it involved, you know, many other countries in the region, and in particular Laos and Cambodia, largely because they share a border with Vietnam. And so it's a long story, but to make it short for our purpose today, the U.S. was really building up its involvement in Vietnam. And as we know, by the late 1950s, the northern Vietnamese leaders had decided that they would support the South in a more aggressive response to American buildup. And so part of why the Hmong became entangled in this war was because of the strategic location in which they lived, near the Vietnamese border, partly in the northeastern part of Laos. And so they became a part of what the strategy of the United States, recruiting, involving many ethnic minorities to fight on their side.
How many Hmong, do we know how many Hmong served during the course of what you said is considered the American War in Southeast Asia?
Mm-hmm. Well, the estimates are that from, you know, the early 1960s, 61, 62, when, you know, Kennedy really supported these counterinsurgency, you know, efforts around the world, it began with a small number, with just about 1,000 people trained by American special forces. But by the end of the war, the estimated number of Hmong troops have been about 40,000. And we have to remember that this is out of a population of about roughly 300,000 at that time. So about 40,000 Hmong combatants fought, you know, on behalf of the United States in what is called, you know, the Secret War of Laos.
And how many Hmong ended up coming to the United States after that?
So if we think about the larger Vietnam War refugees, right, after 1975, after what most people remember as the fall of Saigon, we have about close to 2 million people from the former Indochinese colonies of Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia who left those countries after the Vietnam War. And about 1.4 million came to the United States. And of those, I mean, the majority are Vietnamese, but of that 1.4 million refugees that came to the U.S., about 10%, right? Mm-hmm. About 140,000, a little bit more than 140,000 were Hmong.
And Chia, how is military service on behalf of the Americans viewed in the Hmong community?
For the Hmong, I think for the soldiers, for the officers who served at the time, I think it was a very honorable thing to do because they were also serving the United States, again, fighting, you know, communism at the time. But they were also very much protecting, you know, our families as well. Mm-hmm. And I say our because, you know, I was a child then. And so for them, it was an honorable service that they were, you know, sacrificing themselves to protect, you know, our people as well as fighting for this greater cause. But I think the honest truth is that many people at the time, now in retrospect, you know, in hindsight it's 2020, but at the time, even the military leaders, I've interviewed many, many people, and if people are very honest with themselves, now we know about, you know, what happened and how the U.S., the CIA recruited Hmong to be their soldiers in Laos. But at the time, many people didn't know the larger geopolitical issues. So the awareness became increased as they lived in this country. So it's a very honorable thing for them. And now that they better understand the larger political issues, many who served are very proud for having, you know, participated. But then they also are very bitter. I think many talk about the fact that family and friends and the thousands of people who died, and then the war ended the way it did, right? And so mm-hmm. they are displaced from their homes. Many appreciate being in this country, the opportunities for, you know, people like my generation, the children. But for the elders who served, I mean, they were born to live a very different life, and then they're transplanted into a society that's completely different. Mm-hmm. So whereas they were in a place where they felt honored and they felt they were in charge and they were providing for their families, and then they come to the United States and many have to start all over. In many ways, they didn't speak English. They've had very limited formal education. So just that kind of, overview of their experiences of war, becoming refugees and then migrating to a foreign land. It's been, I think, a very contentious, a difficult journey for the Hmong people who resettle in the United States. But I would like to say that I have traveled all over, you know, the different places in Europe and in South America that other Hmong refugees resettled in. And I would like to say that despite the challenges in the United States, Hmong Americans have had a great deal of support, more than the other locations, largely because of the higher number of refugees who came to this country. And many of us have settled in, you know, as you know, in places like California, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, the three largest state Hmong populations, and people are then able to support each other. So the isolation is initially very difficult, but over time, people build community and a sense of place and sense of belonging much easier than in very isolated places like in Argentina or in other places mm-hmm. in Europe.
We're talking with Chia Yuyi Vang about the recently passed Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act. She's a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is the director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. And before we wrap up, Chia, I want to make sure we do talk about the Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act that was signed into law by President Trump late last month. What does this act specifically provide?
Well, it's sort of a progression, right? Hmong veterans, right when they set foot on this country, have been fighting for a very long time, beginning in, you know, the late 1970s, to because of the, you know, the secret war, right? It wasn't supposed to happen. It was happening. Congress appropriated funding over time. But in terms of the American public, people didn't know that exactly the nature of the war in Laos. So Hmong showed up in this country, and then the education began. So the awareness of their involvement and the extent of the sacrifices and struggles and tragedy for our people became more known only because we became refugees and lived in this country. So this bill is a sort of a part of a long fight that veterans in the community and Americans who served in Laos or American political leaders who have been fighting to recognize Hmong. As you may already know, in 2000, President Clinton signed into law the Hmong Veterans Naturalization Act, which helped to ease the citizenship process for veterans and their families. So this particular legislation, the Hmong Veterans Recognition Act, is very instrumental, I think, for the people who served as well as for the younger generation, because we understand more about our sacrifices. And I think having the United States, having Congress, having the U.S. recognize the services of our elders, for the veterans, they've been waiting for this for a long time. And this legislation, basically what it does is that it enables, it changes, part of the federal legislation that allows veterans to be buried at American National Cemetery. So the legislation is a big win in a way for the Hmong veterans. For those who served and supported U.S. Armed Forces in Laos during the Vietnam War, they are able to be buried at national cemeteries, with the exception of Arlington National Cemetery.
And the way the act is written, my understanding is that this applies to veterans who pass away now and in the future. Obviously, many of these veterans are quite elderly and many have passed away already. Do we know how many veterans who are still alive this would possibly affect?
Yeah, the estimate, there's a number of Hmong veterans groups, so average about, they estimate about maybe a little over 6,000 of the Secret War veterans who are still alive who could benefit from this legislation.
Well, Chia, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chia Yuyi Vang is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is the director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. She joined us to discuss the significance of the recently passed Hmong Veterans Service Recognition Act. First, the Democrats running for governor this fall had one of their first deadlines last week. Ballot signatures were due for anyone who wants to speak at the state party convention this Friday. And as of Saturday at noon, only one candidate, Matt Flynn, had their signatures approved with the Elections Commission. Mordecai Lee is professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where he specializes in government and politics. He's with us to talk about the Democrats looking to take on Governor Scott Walker this fall. Mordecai, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Judith. Glad to be here.
So this coming Friday is the actual deadline to see who will make the ballot and who voters will be voting on in the August Democratic primaries. That's the first official chance to narrow down the long list of Democrats looking to run. But is the field already thinning out?
So far, it doesn't look that way. So far, according to media coverage leading up to the Democratic convention, nobody has said, scratch me off the list. They need, I think it's 2,000 signatures. That's not a very tough threshold to meet. And then they get on the ballot. And Judith, once you get on the ballot, you're on. Even if you drop out, your name still stays on the ballot.
And when there's this large a field, I believe it's 14 people who have said that they intend to submit signatures. Is it expected that all of them will make it onto the ballot, or are there some that just won't be able to make that threshold of getting those 2,000 signatures on nomination papers?
You're right, Judith. For some people who don't have much of a campaign, don't have much money, don't have much experience, it could be the 2,000 is just too much for them. Based on my experience when I was in the state legislature, most Wisconsinites will sign nomination papers. They understand that it's to get on the ballot. It doesn't obligate them beyond that. But I think you're right. I think there might be a small thinning out of the field. But my guess is that by the time the elections board closes, at the close of business on Friday, there are going to be at least 10 names on the ballot, maybe even a baker's dozen.
Hmm. And as we said, the Democratic convention, state convention, starts on Friday. As a result, leadership said that signatures had to be submitted last Friday for them to be able to put people on the agenda to speak at the convention. How important is it for candidates, especially maybe in a crowded field like this, to speak at the convention, to be able to talk to, the kind of core supporters of their party?
Well, absolutely. I mean, when you envision that the people who go to party conventions, whether it's the statewide Republican Party or statewide Democratic Party, that is the core of the core. That's the base. That's the grassroots volunteers. So each of the candidates would very much want to qualify to be able to address them, although it's sort of hard to follow 10 or 12 names. I think what the party had said is that you don't necessarily have to have submitted the 2,000 signatures to the elections board, but you have to demonstrate to the Democratic Party that you had 2,000 signatures
right.
in hand. So I suspect that over the next couple of days, well before Friday, we're going to be hearing all the names.
So how much would you say, Mordecai, the politics of this Democratic field vary? You've got liberal, progressive, moderate. You know, how kind of in percentages, how is that bell curve looking?
Well, it's sort of anybody's game. There's every flavor of a candidate. You're right, Judith. We've got people from different silos of the party. We've got men and women. We've got people from rural Wisconsin, from southeast Wisconsin. We've got people differentiated by age, by political experience or lack of political experience. I think Wisconsin voters will be able to find somebody they particularly like. The problem, of course, is that if you have, let's say, a dozen names on the ballot or 10 names on the ballot, that the person who wins the August primary doesn't need to get a majority of votes. You know, we all sort of grew up believing that you win an election with a majority of votes. In a partisan primary in Wisconsin, you simply have to get more votes than anybody else. That's called a plurality. So, you know, play out the math. Let's say there are 10 to a dozen names on the ballot. Let's say most of them are relatively serious candidates. You can imagine a scenario that somebody becomes the Democratic nominee for governor with, gosh, I don't know, 18, 19, 20% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
That's hardly a majority. And that's sort of a weakness of Wisconsin election law, whether we're talking about Democratic primaries or Republican primaries.
And does that hurt a candidate going into the general if they have only gotten, say, 20% of the vote from their own party?
Judith, I think you've really nailed it, because somebody with 20% of the vote doesn't have much of a mandate, because after all, 80% of the Democratic primary voters voted for somebody else. And so, of course, there will be efforts at party unity. There will be efforts by the party to have money ready for the post-primary campaign. But it's not much of a base. And I think it really sort of hurts democracy with a small d, that we should have a system of government where a party's nominee is the preference of the majority. You know, in the South, they sometimes have things called runoff primaries by the top two vote-getters. I really think in Wisconsin we should have runoff primaries.
And that's certainly something that's used in places like Europe, too.
Absolutely. You narrow down the field to two, and then you have a runoff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, presumably what would happen in Wisconsin is the two survivors might be the best funded, the most well-known, or you might have one from, let's say, the Bernie Sanders wing of the party and one from, let's say, the Clinton wing.
Mm-hmm.
It would be good to have that kind of showdown. That sort of shows you where the heart of the party really is.
Talking with Mordecai Lee right now. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where he specializes in government and politics. And as we approach the Democratic State Convention, we're taking a look at the current field of candidates who would like to be the one to take on Governor Scott Walker in the fall. And Mordecai, I wanted to go back to something that you said, that, you know, it is such a large field and a fairly diverse field in experience and issues that the candidates are really trying to promote. But, you know, I keep thinking there could be a candidate that is a perfect match for a certain voter, but how are they even going to know that? How do you sift through that many candidates to figure out, oh, yeah, you know, candidate X, really, that's my candidate?
You're right, Judith. This is sort of a good news, bad news joke all wrapped up into one, because on the one hand, there are lots of candidates who can offer the voters something that appeals to the voters. But when you have a system that's biased towards, let's say, name recognition and fundraising, or let's say geographical affinity or something along those lines, it's really hard to break through. And, you know, the mainstream media is trying its best to cover all of the candidates equally. But when you've got 10 or 12 people, it's really, really hard to reach them. And so There's some kind of sifting out that's going to happen, and the sifting out might not be for the right reasons. Let's say it's for reasons of the ability to raise $1 million. Well, heck, there are probably some candidates who can't raise $1 million who would be perfectly good candidates. And that's really one of the weaknesses of modern American democracy.
It also seems that there is a danger in trying to differentiate yourself from another candidate, but not coming off as attacking someone who, in the end, is on the same team you are.
You're so right. You know, in Madison Avenue in the 1950s, there used to be a slogan about unique selling proposition, that every advertiser wanted to have a unique selling proposition. So that's probably what we're going to experience for the next 3 months, that each candidate will say, I am uniquely sort of fill in the blank. But do they run negative commercials against whoever they think is the leading opposition? Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? Is that a way to attract attention? Will some of them become irresponsible merely as a way to attract attention? It really is a roll of the dice. Anybody could win.
And as candidates move towards the August primary and beyond, as they hope to do, what tactics, Mordecai, do you think will be the most successful for those vying to take on Governor Walker in November in appealing to voters, but also in raising that money that's necessary to run?
Well, it really reflects our conversation up to this point. To win the primary, they want to have this unique selling proposition. But then running against Governor Walker, they might want to sort of shed that. They might not want to be viewed as, you know, fill in the blank, the pro-choice candidate or the lacrosse candidate or whatever that might be. To win against Governor Walker, they need a broad base of support, and they need to have potential support from all over the state. And so having overly defined themselves in the primary, they might be shooting themselves in the foot for the general.
Well, Mordecai, thank you so much for spending the time with us. I'm sure we'll check back in with you as the race continues.
Thank you, Judith.
That was Mordecai Lee. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where he specializes in government and politics. He was with us to talk about the Democrats running for governor this fall and this week's Democratic State Party Convention. Now, have you ever felt badly about your body? Chances are the answer is a resounding yes. All of us, and especially women, get messages from childhood on about what size and shape our bodies should be. And when we don't fit that, we face criticism from others and also from ourselves. And with warmer weather clothing and activities, it can be even more intense. Jess Baker is hoping to change that. Jess blogs at themilitantbaker.com, and her most recent book is Land Whale, on turning insults into nicknames, why body image is hard, and how diets can kiss my ass. Jess, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. Honored to be here.
So what's your first memory of being made to feel badly about your body, Jess?
I think a lot of it was subconscious, but my very first conscious memory is so clear, and it was in fifth grade, and Danielle called me hippo in class, in Miss Olson's class. And I knew, you know, ever since I knew that fat was a bad thing, I knew that personally, I think hippos are awesome as an adult, but they're pretty strong and incredible creatures. But at the time, I did know it was an insult. And I think that was the beginning of it being called to my face, fifth grade.
And you had an experience that I could really relate to. You were looking through photos from when you were a child, and this was years later, and you had a pretty shocking realization. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely. When I pitched the book, there was a chapter called I Was a Fat Kid. And I spent my entire life, I've been doing body image work for 6 years now, dissecting body image. Like, I felt like I kind of knew it all when it came to myself anyways. Went back for this chapter for some inspiration, looked through my old pictures, and I realized that, you know, I kept flipping, looking for this fat child that I remember being, and I was not a fat child at all. In fact, I was quite a thin child until puberty. And that was just mind-blowing to me, because this is not the first time I had looked at those pictures either. Mm-hmm. And I had somehow superimposed this other body onto myself because I grew up feeling fat, being told that I was too fat, even though I really wasn't. I was really internalizing other people's messages. So it was incredible to go back and realize that, you know, this entire history that I have feeling like a fat child growing up as a fat child was, in fact, you know, a lie. It was a mental state of being.
I went to a Catholic grade school and high school, actually, but in grade school, the uniforms, there were box pleat skirts for girls who were considered of a normal size and weight. And then there was an all-around pleated skirt for those that were considered too heavy to wear the box pleats. And I remember being in probably sixth or seventh grade, and two of us were assigned to the all-pleated skirts, and knowing exactly what that meant, that we were considered too large to wear the box pleats. And I remember thinking, somewhat before that, but definitely after that, I'm fat. I'm a fat kid. I'm a fat girl. And then years later, I looked back at photos of myself from freshman year in high school. I wasn't fat at all. And it was that's the realization that I had that so resonated with me when I read about yours.
Wow. Yeah. Body dysmorphia is so real. And I think that, I look at myself 10 years ago, I'm 31 now. I was 21 then. And I was, at the point where I was suicidal because I hated my body so much. And I look back at those pictures now and I'm just like, man, I am and was so beautiful and I just wasn't able to see it. So we have this lens that we're given. We weren't born hating ourselves like this. We were given that lens. We were taught that skirt was the wrong skirt to have. And we then see the world very, very differently. And that's really what I'm hoping to change for some people, is to kind of take off that lens and see what we're really looking at, because life is to be lived now. And I think a lot of people can identify with both of our experiences.
Mm-hmm. You talk a lot, Jess, about how women's bodies are heavily policed in our society. Can you give us some concrete examples of where you see that happening?
Yes. Yeah, it's everywhere. I think bodies are policed in general. I think that in our current society, anything other than a thin, white, able-bodied, straight-presenting, cisgender person is going to be very politicized and, different. And we're going to take that difference and we're going to talk about it and talk about how it's not okay. But I think that, historically, women's bodies have been... targets of marketing ever since. There's a long history behind why we hate our body here in the U.S. and it has a lot to do with our economy and making money at post-World War II. But we really do like to regulate women's bodies, their choices, their sizes, what they wear. I think rape culture is a place that you see that. We place the blame on the woman for what she was wearing instead of the actions of the other person. And it's so common to comment on other people's bodies as well. And we really do believe that women owe society their desirability. And so you see a lot of pushback when some women say, I don't owe you thinness or beauty or prettiness or any of that. We see a lot of pushback. And so in those ways, we're always policed. We walk down the street, people are able to comment on our body. In the communities of women, other women comment on other women's bodies. It's just everyone has something to say because we've made a culture where that's acceptable and normalized. And sometimes we even feel like it's our duty, like it's our service to critique and criticize the physical appearance of other people.
We're talking with Jess Baker. She's an activist and author. Her most recent book is Land Whale, and she's looking at how people can learn to love their bodies no matter what size or shape they come in. And, you really are pushing back against that policing of women's bodies, that there should be an expectation that others impose on us or that we impose on ourselves about what size and shape our bodies should be. And you have tattoos on your thighs to remind you of that, because even though you're steeped in this, you still need that reinforcement. Can you tell us about those tattoos?
Yeah, they're my favorite ones. They're right over my knees, and one knee says my life and the other one says my rules. And I think it is important to remember to mention, I'm glad you mentioned it, that I do need reminders. And even though this is something that I know all bodies are worthy, and I know why we've learned to hate our bodies, and I know all of the reasons behind the struggles that we have, I still have, difficult days because this is the world we live in. And so a lot of people, kind of want to have 100% impeccable body days. I'm going to learn to love myself and everything's going to be perfect from here on out. And that's just not realistic because we've learned this for so long. So yes, I do have tattoos and they are perfect reminders for those hard days that everyone has.
One of the things that I found really touching, because you're so vulnerable about it in Land Whale, is that you have been with your partner for several years. You clearly have a very strong relationship that you really work on. And one of the things that you both have committed to is absolute honesty all the time under all circumstances. And yet you have a really hard time believing when he says that you're sexy and you're beautiful and you're desirable and he wouldn't want to be with anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes. Some days I'm like, you know it. You know, like, I know you're lucky. And it's wonderful and beautiful. And sometimes the old teachings do sneak into my head. And when there is a comment that he makes about how beautiful I look, we've developed this incredible way to twist the beautiful things in life and make them negative. So he says, oh, you know, you look really great in that dress for this reason. I'm like, well, why wasn't it the other reason? And I've kind of perfected the art of hating myself, and I can take even a positive comment and make it very negative. And so we're working through that, but it's true. That does come up. And one thing that's really helped is, one, me doing my own personal work to unlearn these lies that I've been taught by society. And also just knowing that I can trust him. We've said the hard things that were, you know, felt impossible to say. We always have. And so when he does give me a compliment, when he does say these wonderful, lovely things, I know logically, even if I can't internalize it, I know logically that he is being completely honest. And I feel like that's a blessing. I'm very grateful to have that.
Has he expressed frustration that sometimes it can be so hard for you to believe what he so clearly is meaning in a very genuine way?
That's a great question. We have talked about it. I worry about that more than he does. I always worry that, you know, oh, this is going to be too hard for him to constantly have to be positive. But it's not a struggle for him because he finds it so easy to love me. And he explained this to me when we were dating about this, you know, certain monsters of art, you know, they're different for each person. And my monsters, they're not his monsters. Mm-hmm. His monsters are not my monsters. So it's easier for him to help me fight mine than it is for me to fight them alone. And then I, in turn, help him fight his monsters because they're different for me and it's not as difficult. So we kind of trade off on the battlefront there. And he is able to help me. And I'm grateful for that support, to have that every day.
We're talking with author and activist Jess Baker about her most recent book, Land Whale. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you struggle to love your body? Where do you think you got the message that you're not fine the way you are? Have you made progress in not only accepting your body, but maybe even celebrating it? Or maybe you're from a culture that has different ideas about beauty. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with author and activist Jess Baker about resisting fat shaming from ourselves and others and how we can come to love our bodies unconditionally. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How comfortable do you feel in your body? Are you hard on yourself because of its size or its shape? Or maybe you found a way to accept yourself and love how you look. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Jess, you know, many people will say that we're in the midst of an obesity crisis and that fat shaming is actually based on a concern for health, but you're not buying that.
No, and there's a lot of research and logic and science that backs that up as well. I think that this is what everyone always wants to get to. And if we dance around it, it'll eventually come down to health. And people are very concerned about people loving themselves no matter what, because they feel like this promotes obesity. Obesity is just pathologizing fatness. And some bodies are just fat. Some bodies are fat for a ton of different reasons. And they could, I mean, there's just so many different reasons why fat could be a symptom of something else. And or maybe there isn't a problem. The interesting thing I think about health is that what we don't talk about is how there are multiple components to health, and it's multifaceted. It looks different for each person. And so when we paint health with one big brushstroke, we often leave out a lot of ways that we can help people and live a healthy, holistic life. We kind of skip over them and end up harming them in the end. Fat shaming, which is interesting that you just named that as a way of like creating change. Fat shaming has been proven to cause weight gain. So that's obviously not something mm-hmm. that's going to be helpful if you really are concerned about people gaining weight. Personally, I have read and spoken to enough professionals to know that underneath all of us, there are so many different levels of things that need to be resolved and taken care of. The problem happens that we run into is when fat people go to the doctor, oftentimes the fatness is treated instead of whatever might be causing fatness. And so a lot of things go undiagnosed. Sometimes there's a lot of body shaming, so fat people don't ever go back to the doctor, which, of course, you know, we want to make sure that we're taking care of our bodies. But I think ultimately what it boils down to is that it's really difficult to take care of a body, to take care of something that you absolutely hate. Mm. And so I don't think that a lot of progress comes from hating ourselves into this form of health that people require of us or we are told that we need. It looks different for everyone. I believe that holistic wellness, looking at ourselves, body, brain, spirituality, all of those things all together, ultimately, and coming from a place of love and acceptance is a much better way to approach well-being than a lot of the, you know, throwing BMI numbers at people or other ways that we really do shame fat bodies.
We're talking about loving our bodies and rejecting fat shaming and body shaming with Jess Baker. She's an activist and author. You can join in by calling 800-642-1234. And Jess, you had kind of an interesting, I would say, fairly different experience growing up than a lot of people. You actually got a lot of the messages about your body and it not being acceptable in the size and shape that it was from your father. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, women can be really hard on each other and on themselves. And so I was kind of surprised when you said that a lot of it came from your father. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Yeah, I think it is less common for it to come from a father figure. Often is passed down from mother to daughter. My dad really struggled with his own body image issues. And ultimately, I mean, I worked in mental health for quite a few years, so I love to break things like this down. But ultimately, I believe that, and in talking to him, that, you know, there was a lot of struggle to control aspects of his life. He felt very out of control. And I think this is common for children too. When we feel out of control, sometimes the only thing we feel like we can control or we're told that we can control is our body. And so he really put a lot of focus on his body. He was constantly dieting. Diets are essentially yo-yo diets. You know, the vast majority of them don't work. So he would try one, he would lose a lot of weight. And then he would gain it all back and more, and then he would do another one. And it was this constant roller coaster of dieting in my life. And I absorbed all of that from him, not only just the idea that we constantly need to be restricting and over-exercising in order to be okay, but also, you know, this is how diet works. This is how you live your life. And if you're not doing these things, you're not okay. I think I also picked up a lot of his just internalized hatred of anybody that didn't look like what we saw on television. I think you can pick that up from a lot of different places, but that was one I did get directly from my father. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting for me to go through my journey. I'm watching him on his journey as he's aging. And yeah, it's really quite fascinating. My mom is on her own journey as well. We're all kind of just figuring things out, and we all will be for a very long time. I think, you know, this isn't an end destination. I think we're all trying to figure out what's best for us individually.
Jess, one of the things that I really enjoyed in reading your book and looking at your blog and looking at photos of you is that you have an amazing sense of style. You wear really great makeup and clothing, and you're really a presence. And I think that a lot of people who are living in larger bodies go the opposite way. They try to shrink and take up as little space as possible. And you're a real presence, and you talk about other fat women who have inspired you in that way.
Yeah, we are taught to take up as little space as possible, physically, emotionally, energetically, just really, you know, cross your legs, make yourself as small as possible, diet, don't talk, be polite, all of those different restrictions. I am not naturally that person, never have been. Even as a kid, I was just, I'm a Leo, so that says a lot. And also, I think it is very important for people to learn that they are valuable enough to take up the space they need to exist and live their best life. Whatever that is for a person, it's going to look different for everyone. But just not to have those restrictions is really important. I am a loud person. I'm fat. I'm tattooed. I'm a Leo who likes to be on the stage. So I do take up a lot of space. But people don't need to necessarily be always in horizontal stripes and bright colors. I think it's just, it comes down to deciding what you really love and then doing that. Mm-hmm. And if, I think the sad part is when we don't know that we have a choice and we think that we must hide, we must make ourselves as small as possible, we must disappear. That's what makes me sad. But if, you know, living a quiet life in beige is your jam, then I'm all for it, as long as that's what you really want to do.
And, you know, Jess, I have to say, I felt kind of naive reading your book because I was shocked that you have experienced so often throughout your life people on the street calling you derogatory names, you know, referring to your size in very unkind ways. And I guess I didn't want to think that that was as common as it was. But what would you like people to consider before they open their mouths and say those kinds of things to a stranger or certainly to a loved one?
Oh, my God. Well, there's two things. One, you can think about the other person. I know why people say these things, but I don't know if people understand why it comes out of their mouth. Just don't do it to another person. Just don't humiliate another human. Just don't do that. What it ends up looking like is those comments are really just a reflection of how a person is feeling inside. So if somebody is going to go on the internet or in person, take the time to call me a name that is supposed to harm me. I know that that's coming from a place where a person is feeling so not okay that they need to harm someone else in order to feel better. And so please don't do that to people. And also know that there are those of us who have experienced this for so long that realize it's just a reflection of you. So either you're going to really hurt someone, which should not be anyone's goal for a day, or we're just going to acknowledge, you know, this person has some stuff going on that they need to figure out. And so that's neither of those outcomes are really great. Mm-hmm. So I would maybe focus on, if you feel like saying it, say it in your head and then ask yourself why you are so upset about another person in their body. And you might have some very interesting revelations if you ask yourself that question.
Well, Jess, thanks so much for spending the time with us today. It was a great conversation.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Jess Baker is an activist and author. Her most recent book is Land Whale, on turning insults into nicknames, why body image is hard, and how diets can kiss my ass. She also blogs at themilitantbaker.com, and she joined us to talk about resisting fat shaming from ourselves and others and how we can come to love our bodies.